First of all, I want to thank everybody for inviting me here to speak today on this issue. I know it's a little bit out of the realm of what many of you guys are used to, but I think a lot of it's going to fit well with some of the things that you've been discussing already. By now, most of us have heard the various reasons that ethanol has been in high demand in this country, anything ranging from improving our energy security by reducing our dependence on foreign oil, to cleaning up the environment, to providing diversified opportunities for our rural landowners. And of course, with this increased demand, we've seen an increase in production as well. In fact, the Renewable Fuels Association has said between about the year 2000 and 2007 or so, there's been over a 430% increase in ethanol production in the United States. And of course, because most of this is corn-based ethanol at this point, it doesn't come as a surprise that many of the ethanol refineries that we're seeing that are currently in operation, as well as those that are being constructed, do fall in what we would consider to be the Corn Belt of the United States: Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, the eastern part of the Dakotas. What's interesting, though, is even with the increase in production, it doesn't seem to be keeping pace with the increase in demand. And so, as a result, we've seen politicians moving more towards alternative-based feedstocks. President Bush, in his 2006 State of the Union address, espoused the goal of making cellulosic ethanol practical and competitive within 6 years. And of course, that was then followed by a series of policies, including the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, which made it a goal to produce 36 billion gallons of ethanol by the year 2022, up from roughly 9 billion that was projected in 2008. What's interesting about this act, however, is that after the year about 2015, all of the ethanol production has to come from alternative-based feedstocks and not corn-based ethanol. And one of those feedstocks that's received considerable attention, of course, is switchgrass, and for good reason. Switchgrass is a very robust plant, as we all know. It can grow 6 to 10 feet tall. Because of its robust nature, it tends to withstand wind erosion, which reduces evaporation, increases soil moisture retention. It's a native C4 perennial grass, capable of being grown on marginal lands, which oftentimes won't be used for crop production anyway. But what's really nice about this particular plant is it has a very deep, dense rooting system. This diagram's a little misleading. It only shows 80 centimeters of penetration, when in fact those root systems can go 10 feet or more down into the soil surface. And of course, this is going to be very important in terms of sequestering carbon from the atmosphere, putting it back into the soil. It also provides excellent invertebrate habitat as we start getting into some of these wildlife issues, which then translates into wonderful nesting and breeding habitat for things like pheasants, waterfowl, and because of the robust structure of the plant, we can even provide some great overwinter cover for species like white-tailed deer. The deep rooting system of switchgrass is not restricted to switchgrass alone. In fact, this is characteristic of many of our native plant species that we see in prairie systems, especially the grasses. And what's nice about these native prairie systems is they tend to act like sponges, almost. They absorb the nutrients and place them back into the soil. They reduce off-site sedimentation. And this has a number of ecological wildlife benefits. If you look at wetlands that are surrounded by native prairie grasslands, what you tend to find is that these wetlands are going to have lower nutrient levels, which means reduced algal growth, deeper waters, less sedimentation. Those deeper waters are going to have higher oxygen levels. They're going to be cooler, and they're going to be more attractive to species like trout, pike, smallmouth bass, some of those species that we're really interested in getting. You compare that to what we tend to see right now, especially in eastern South Dakota, are these wetlands surrounded by croplands that tend to have high nutrient loads, high algal growth, a lot of sedimentation. They're much shallower, much warmer, and as a result, we end up with a lot less desirable fish species such as carp, bullhead, and catfish. All of us are familiar with the work by Dr. David Tillman at the University of Minnesota, where he planted a series of plots ranging in anything from 1 to 16 different native plant species, and then he measured a number of different outputs as a result of this. And in general, what he found is that as you increased plant species diversity, you tended to see an increased return in carbon sequestration, fewer competition with noxious weeds, less disease, which then of course could translate into fewer inputs in terms of chemicals, fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides. So there's a lot of potential benefits with increased plant diversity. What caught a lot of people's attention too is that he actually did measure biomass energy output as well, and again, with an increased increased richness, plant species richness, we tended to see an increase in biomass energy produced compared to monotypic stands like switchgrass. Now, I think a lot of us are familiar with the fact that this got some criticism because the sites on which they were growing these plots are probably, the soils are not very typical of where a lot of these native plant prairie plant species would be grown in large quantities. However, if this research holds true for the Midwest, it really does have a lot of potential benefits because it's generally believed that as you have an increase in plant species diversity, you're also going to end up with an increase in wildlife species diversity for a number of different reasons. Another thing that was interesting about the research is a lot of the different plant species that he looked at are typical components of many of our CRP grass mixtures or plant species mixtures. And there's been a lot of talk about provisions in the Farm Bill for using CRP lands for biomass production. One of the benefits of CRP that really wasn't an intention when the Farm Bill was created in 1985 is wildlife production. These lands have been extremely productive for wildlife. One study has shown that for every 4% increase in CRP land, there was a 22% increase in pheasant populations. Another study by a guy in the Fish and Wildlife Service, Reynolds, in 2005, he attributed more than 2 million ducks being contributed to the migratory path because of CRP lands in those areas. Unfortunately, a lot of these CRP contracts are currently coming to their end, and we're seeing a lot of conversion back into the row crop agriculture. And if you look at a map like this that shows minimum percentage loss of CRP between 2007 and 2010, you can see that South Dakota, eastern South Dakota, is right smack dab in the middle of all this. What's worse, though, is if you look at the density of breeding duck pairs, you'll also see that this is the exact same region that we tend to have the highest density of nesting pairs of ducks in the country. These are very, very productive wildlife lands. In fact, the prairie pothole region that I'm talking about has been shown to contribute more than 50% of the game birds in this country, even though it only contains about 10% of the breeding habitat. One study that I looked at said that more than 80% of our game birds or waterfowl use this area. So it's, again, any small change in this region in terms of habitat is going to have very dramatic effects on our waterfowl populations. The prairie pothole, as many of you know, is also very attractive for pheasant hunters. Last year alone, South Dakota Game Fish and Parks said that it pulled in more than $219 million from roughly 176,000 pheasant hunters. If you work that out, that's about $1,250 per hunter coming into the economy of South Dakota. So with a large number of CRP contracts set to expire here within the next year or so, we obviously have to start looking into the potential implications of converting these grasslands or these CRP lands for biomass production. And this has really led into the research that I'm conducting at South Dakota State University that's being funded by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, Anheuser-Busch, in conjunction with South Dakota Game Fish and Parks and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It is an interdisciplinary effort. It involves four different departments at South Dakota State University, including the Department of Plant Science, the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries Science, the Department of Economics, and Olson Biochemistry Laboratory. The main objectives of this research, at least originally, were to determine which combinations of stubble height, residual stubble height, and season of harvest were most beneficial for maximizing biomass production and quality on these mixed grass native grasslands, while at the same time minimizing the potential impacts on nesting success and diversity of our economically important game bird species. Since we started the work, we've also added a migratory grassland songbird component to the research. And ultimately, we hope to conduct a full economic analysis looking at the potential trade-offs between how much biomass we can produce and the quality of that biomass versus what we might be losing in terms of economically important game bird production. We have gone through a full year of this, and one of the things that became very evident the first year is that we were going to run into some major problems in the spring in trying to get these treatments applied. In South Dakota, we went from about 3 feet of snow to 3 feet of mud in 2 weeks. I'll never get used to South Dakota. And so we couldn't get the heavy equipment in there to do that. As a result, we've had to change our objectives a little bit, and we're now looking only at a fall-only harvest, and we've removed that spring harvest treatment. So if you look at the study design right now, kind of this is the way it's set up. We've got a completely randomized block design with five different blocks located around southeastern South Dakota. Each one of those blocks contains five different plots that are roughly 40 acres in size or so. On those five different plots, we're applying different stubble height treatments, either a 12-inch, a 4-inch, or a no-harvest control. Originally, the design was a two-factor factorial looking at season of harvest and stubble height, but since we removed the season of harvest, we're now replicating those stubble heights twice on those plots. The plots are located on state-owned game production areas, federally owned waterfowl production areas, and privately owned CRP lands. In terms of pheasants and waterfowl, we're using standard nest dragging and hockey stick methods to look for nests. We're recording species, clutch size, age of the nest, based on different techniques, flotation and candling, and also determining nest fate, long-term nest fate. For our songbirds, we're using standard strip transect techniques three times throughout the year to get the early migrators as well as the late migrators. And each male seen and heard is going to be spot mapped, so we get the geographical location as well. We're also looking at vegetation structure, which has been highly correlated with different songbird composition. In terms of the actual vegetation, we've got a series of three 100-meter line transects in each plot where we're recording things like percent cover and plant composition, which we hope to eventually tie back to overall yield on these plots. And along each one of these transects, we've set out a series of 10 quarter-meter squared plots that we're harvesting to then do a full chemical composition with Olson Biochemistry Laboratory at South Dakota State University, looking at mineral content, sugars, lignin, cellulose, and potential overall ethanol production. As we get these results, they're all being fed over to the Department of Economics at SDSU. We've got a new professor there who's extremely excited about the research. He's going to be looking at total production, collection, storage, as well as transportation issues with cellulosic biomass, and then also factoring in economic losses due to reduced game bird production. Because of the rough field season, we didn't get a lot of really good results. However, my graduate student on the game bird production did find 220 nests, 49 of which were pheasants, 147 which were ducks. Pheasant nest success rate was much lower than that of ducks, 14% compared to 46%. Again, because we didn't get all the harvest treatments in, it's hard to compare harvested versus unharvested plots. But in general, what we're seeing is that with unharvested plots, we're seeing much higher nest densities. In terms of songbirds, what was nice is we are seeing a lot of what we would hope to see, some of the grassland species, including bobolinks, dick thistles, savanna, and grasshopper sparrows. But what took us by surprise is that we're also picking up a lot of marshland-type birds, which would include things like sedge wrens and red-winged blackbirds. So what's very clear to us at this point is that we're going to, before we can really factor out the treatment effects of stubble height on these songbirds, we're going to have to account for the different wetland sizes that tend to be in these plots. In terms of the biofuel quality analysis, I was hoping to have a lot more detail in terms of the fall versus the spring harvest for you guys. We are still getting results back from the lab, but as you can see, we're getting a lot of very detailed information, so it should make for a really good paper here in another year or so. So where does this leave us? Well, we're really at the beginning when it comes to wildlife and biomass impacts. As I mentioned, we took out the seasonal treatment, so we're going to have to look at that. And then we're going to have to look at much more large-scale type impacts of biofuels harvest, including different harvesting techniques and management, arrangement of the harvest, frequency. But we also have to look at the agronomic aspects in terms of you know, can we establish these crops using cover crops or interseeding, and how's that going to then translate into wildlife impacts? And we are starting to do some of that research. I did not have time, obviously, in this session to add in all that information, but I'd be happy to talk to you about some of the new research we're starting that are going to be looking at some of these issues. And of course, ultimately, our goal is to develop best management practices that establish protocols to maximize biomass production and quality while minimizing impacts on biodiversity. It's really an exciting time to be in wildlife because I've been called to the table by people I would never have imagined getting into this field that I'd be called to the table with, biochemists and all sorts of things, to contribute to these projects. And so it's very exciting. And I do believe that what's good for biofuel can eventually be good for wildlife as well. Again, I want to thank ASA, CSSA, and SSSA for inviting me here today, especially Dr. Thielen and Dr. Wiersma, as well as all my collaborators, the Sun Grant Institution at South Dakota State University, my graduate students, everybody I can't possibly list. With that, if we have time, I will take a few questions. Some of the research that I wasn't able to get to today, a lot of it is based more on the agronomy side of things, which means we're dealing with much smaller plots that are not conducive to looking at large-scale wildlife studies. So we've had to resort to looking at things like insect diversity, and we are starting to do some of that on our smaller plots, small mammals included. One of the challenges we have in the wildlife profession is that it's very hard, coming back to the economics, to be able to put a dollar figure on wildlife. It's okay with game species, which is why this was funded to begin with. But when we start looking at non-game, insect diversity, things like that, it's very hard to get funding for this. So I think that's part of the reason it's been hard to get people on board. But again, because we're looking at green energies now, the wildlife component is definitely becoming a factor, and it's wonderful. The hockey stick method. It's what it sounds like. I didn't know about this until I came to South Dakota either. It's a hockey stick. You essentially get a line of people together, and they use hockey sticks to just part the vegetation and find nests. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. We use what we can in wildlife science.